From the studios of Kootenai Co-op Radio, this is Deconstructing Dinner.
And welcome to Deconstructing Dinner, produced in Nelson, British Columbia at Kootenai Co-op Radio, CJLY. I'm John Steinman. You can follow this weekly radio show through one of our 48 participating radio stations in Canada and the United States, or through our podcast and archived episodes, linked to from our website at deconstructingdinner.ca. From there, you can also stay updated through our Facebook and Twitter pages. Today, we visit with two ongoing subjects that we've been focusing on as of late: the future of Canada's rehabilitative and food producing prison farms, and backyard hens. This will be the first of a two-part feature on the City of Vancouver's multi-year process, which on June 8th culminated into the official passing of a bylaw that permits the raising of up to 4 chickens per household. Because there are now many similar debates being waged among city councils across the country, we'll launch this first of a two-part feature on Vancouver's efforts by looking back over the past few years to track just how this process first began, and perhaps other hopeful or illegal backyard chickeners can glean some pointers from Vancouver's efforts. And on the prison farm front, some updates on the ongoing campaign to save Canada's 6 prison farms. It's a topic we've been following closely, and one that even more Canadians have become aware of following well-known Canadian author Margaret Atwood joining the fight. We'll learn about that and more, including the now in place 24-hour citizen watch set up across the street from Kingston, Ontario's Frontenac Institution, where residents there are keeping a close eye on the prison farm, making sure that the 300-animal dairy herd does not get trucked off the property to auction. The future of Canada's prison farms. It's a multi-part series here on the show, and the title of which is seeming to become more certain: Closed. Despite the ongoing and vocal opposition to the closure of Canada's over 100-year-old prison farm program, Canada's Conservative-led government appears to be carrying out their highly questionable decision as planned. In question were the quite hollow and, in some cases, shocking reasons provided for closing the farms, which have been operating as one of a number of rehabilitative and job training programs managed by the Correctional Service of Canada. All 3 of Canada's opposition parties have too vocally denounced the decision, and on our last episode on the issue, airing back in April, Liberal members of Canada's Standing Committee on Public Safety and National Security tabled motions calling for a halt to the closures until an independent review is conducted. Despite the opposition representing the majority of Canadians, the Conservative-led government is not obliged to listen, leading many supporters of the prison farm program to call the ongoing closures as an affront to democracy. Without many other political avenues available to opposition parties and members of Parliament, Liberal MP Mark Holland rose on May 26th in the House of Commons and requested an emergency debate. Holland is the Liberals' opposition critic on public safety and national security.
The chair has notice of an application for an emergency debate from the honourable member from Ajax Pickering, so I'll hear the member now.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Pursuant to Standing Order 52, I'm requesting an emergency debate on the closure of the prison farm program. Several irreplaceable components of the farm operation are set to be sold and dispersed by June of 2010. These include a heritage dairy herd with a prize-winning genetics at Frontenac Institution and a prize dairy herd at Westmoreland Institution. The auction date for a gold herd standard at Rockwood Institution is also imminent. Once these herds have been dispersed, they can never be reestablished. In short, Mr. Speaker, if these herds are allowed to be sold, it will mean the end of the prison farm program, one of the most successful programs we've had in the country in rehabilitating inmates. I've had the occasion to visit all of the nation's prison farms, to meet with correctional officers who've told their stories about how these programs transform these men. The opportunity to work with animals and animal husbandry is something that's extremely effective and on the leading edge of rehabilitation, and yet this government is closing the program. Closing a program that they say costs $4 million and yet will provide no costing for. At a time when prison costs are soaring and the government is spending literally billions and billions on prisons, it seems backward in the extreme to be cutting or axing a program that is so desperately needed to help rehabilitate those that are about to re-enter. And given the fact that over 90% of inmates will leave prison and will re-enter, how they rehabilitate is essential. And when I talk to correctional officials who tell me that working over 30 years in the program, they've never seen a single instance of violent recidivism. When I look into the eyes of men who talk to me about how this program has transformed their lives, I think it's extremely important that this House has a debate before the Conservatives shut down a program that has been this effective for more than 100 years. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
I thank the Honourable Member for his remarks and for the letter that he sent to the Speaker earlier today. I regret to inform him that I don't believe that his request falls under the provisions for an emergency, doesn't meet the requirements for the provisions for an emergency debate, so I'll be declining the request at this time.
Member of Parliament for the Ontario Riding of Ajax-Pickering, Mark Holland, and an unssuccessful attempt on May 26th to introduce an emergency debate on the now-in-process closure of Canada's prison farms. While political avenues appear to have been exhausted, opponents to the closure on the ground seem to only be strengthening their campaign. On June 6th, Canadian author Margaret Atwood joined the fight to save the farms at a rally attended by an estimated 1,000 people on the streets of Kingston, Ontario. Marchers made their way to the regional headquarters of the Correctional Service of Canada and posted their demands on the front door, a video of which is linked to from the Deconstructing Dinner website. With the march led by Margaret Atwood herself, her presence has no doubt helped further inform Canadians about the closures by encouraging a wave of new local and national media coverage. Deconstructing Dinner has put together here a short collage of audio from that June 6th rally featuring the words of Margaret Atwood, Sister Pauline Lally of the Sisters of Providence of St. Vincent de Paul, and area farmer Eric McBay. The original audio heard here is courtesy of the Save Our Prison Farms campaign.
Ho, ho! We don't want those farms to go! Hey, hey! Ho, ho! We don't want those farms to go! Hey, hey! Ho, ho! We don't want those farms to go!
Are you listening? Are you living up to the promises on which you got elected long ago? Accountability, responsibility, transparency, and access for the taxpayer. Or have you shut yourselves up in a mental prison of your own construction? Taxpayers' dollar, you need listen to nobody but yourselves, like some old-style absolute monarch surrounded by yes-men and flunkies. It's time to come down from your ideological palace and get down to earth, because that's where the food comes from.
Rehabilitating inmates is corrections' responsibility and reflects Canadian values in ways that outdated notions of punishment can never do. Canadians respect governments that listen. And there is nothing wrong in a government that listens and changes its mind.
This isn't merely a matter of federal policy or budget cuts. We're choosing between two futures today. On one hand, we have a future in which a farmer's work is valued and agriculture is vital, in which we can produce the food that we need, and in which people are willing to stand up for the good of their communities. On the other hand, we have a dimmer future, in which farmland is sacrificed for super prisons and industrial development, in which prisoner rehabilitation has been discarded for prisoner punishment, and in which people are afraid to step out of line when government makes a bad decision. I know which future I want. Our demands are clear and they're simple. The Conservative government must accept a moratorium on the prison farm closures and implement a full and independent review. Today, we show our numbers and our commitment in a small act of civil disobedience. But if the government fails to address these concerns in a prompt and timely fashion, we'll use escalating measures of civil disobedience until the Conservatives have no choice but to act responsibly.
Clips from the June 6th rally in Kingston, Ontario, where author Margaret Atwood joined the campaign to save Canada's prison farm program. Only 1 week later, the campaign headed north to Ottawa, where a full day of events was organized. About 150 people of all ages, ethnicities, and political stripes gathered on Victoria Island in the Ottawa River for a sacred fire ceremony led by Peter DeConte from Maniwaki. 18 canoes then set out down the river to deliver their message in front of the Parliament building, a message that, quote, "Prison farms belong to all Canadians. Stop ignoring democracy. Save the farms now," end quote. Joining the effort was the 97-year-old spiritual and hereditary chief of the Algonquin Nation, William Commanda, whose words are heard here being read by Romola Troublecock.
Very grateful that Grandfather William Commanda, Algonquin elder, was with us today to offer a prayer to launch the effort to save the prison farms. And these are his formal remarks. "Today, we launch this prayer to save the prison farms from the sacred meeting grounds of my ancestors, Assiniboia. With the system of justice that came with the colonization of our lands, came the notions that crime equals punishment, and that punishment equals incarceration and suffering. In the indigenous worldview, wrongdoing could be caused by not knowing better. Therefore, one needed to be taught. Or, wrongdoing could be caused by sickness. Therefore, one needed to be healed. Indigenous peoples always knew Mother Earth was the greatest teacher and healer, and her stones, her soil, her waters, her plants, and her animals brought us deep teaching and deep healing over the centuries. Our sacred relationship with Mother Earth has been defiled across the globe, and today we see the disastrous consequences everywhere, every day. We do not feel safe either. Prison farms represent one way to reconcile broken souls with the source of all life. Today, we light a fire for the prayer that Indigenous values will be restored to guide us all back to a reconnection with Mother Earth and each other. The spirit of the first baby bison born on a Canadian prison farm over 20 years ago, and this crown of thorns plant from the same Saskatchewan Farm Riverbend Institution in a stone vase given to Grandfather Commander many years ago by Brian Bowers, a voice from the justice system and a voice from the community, join with our energies to transform hearts and minds to a deeper understanding of the complex issues we all need to grapple with together on this journey of life on Turtle Island. Miigwech."
This is Deconstructing Dinner. Those were the words of William Commanda of the Algonquin Nation. Also at the rally was the National Farmers Union's Jeff Peters, who had only just witnessed former Minister of Public Safety Peter Van Loan walk by the rally being held on the lawn of Parliament Hill.
"Farming is the backbone of our country, of all of rural Canada. And when Peter Van Loan, I just saw him walk up the sidewalk with his head down. He's got a guilty conscience. He gave us one last look up there. Will they ever go away? And we will not quit. I promise you, we will not give in to what we see as an injustice for our democratic system."
Also at the June 15th rally was political representation from Liberal members Mark Holland and Wayne Easter, the NDP's Alex Adamanenko, and the Bloc Québécois' Maria Morani, who, despite being from Quebec, where no prison farms are located, stood in solidarity with the effort and the principles upon which the campaign is based. Here's a clip of Wayne Easter, Maria Morani, and Alex Adamanenko addressing the rally.
"Firm skills equals life skills.
Yes.
It's all about rehabilitation, working with animals and seeing a purpose in life. And it's often working with those animals. You know, I had one inmate, I'm not sure whether it was in Dorchester or in at the Frontenac Institution, who said to me that, you know, he's been in the system. He was 51. He's been in the system pretty near all his life. And he said, I never became a real person until I actually got to work with these milk cows. with that dairy herd. They made him a real person because, you know, he related to the livestock, to the animals, and he developed some love for those livestock. And that's what working on a farm and a prison, on a prison farm does for these people. It gives them skills in life and makes them see the value of all living things, whether it's humans or whether it's animals. And that, and we're going to lose that with this government and its entrenched position, and that's it.
C'est un grand plaisir d'être aujourd'hui avec vous aujourd'hui parce que nous croyons vraiment aux prisons, aux fermes de prison. C'est un très bon outil de réhabilitation. Et si nous sommes ici, je vais vous le dire bien franchement, au Québec, il n'y a pas de prison, de ferme de prison. Mais on est quand même ici parce qu'on croit à la solidarité à travers tout le Canada et aussi parce qu'on croit à la réhabilitation. Voici pourquoi aujourd'hui on est là et on a donné notre appui sans faille pour maintenir les fermes de prison.
The idea that we have viable prison farms that contribute to the local economy, that have land set aside for the future, for our food sovereignty and food security, it to me seems a no-brainer. But this shouldn't even be a debate on this. And yet we're here, we're having to...
And the last clip to share from the June 15th rally in front of Canada's Parliament buildings is of Andrew McCann of Urban Agriculture Kingston.
But we've always tried to stress in this campaign that this is a lightning rod issue that allows us to shine a light on misguided farm and food policy in general from our government, not just the Conservatives, other governments before them. And we are asking to think about the prison farms as local food. One of the banners on the canoes here today says prison farms equal local food. And that's a huge message that I think Canadians at this point in time understand much better than their government in terms of the direction of the future of agriculture and food systems in this country.
Some other updates on the Save Our Prison Farms campaign include information gathered by Canada's National Farmers Union from an ad issued by the Government of Canada that points to just how much the milk being produced on those farms was valued at. The ad was seeking a milk supplier who can provide milk to three locations in Ontario where federal penitentiaries are located. Those facilities have long received milk produced on the prison farms, but if all goes as planned, that relationship will, of course, no longer exist. The value of the contract is at just under $1 million, with Kingston's Frontenac Institution also having provided milk to Quebec institutions. An ad will also need to be issued for that contract too, likely bringing the value of the milk that had been produced at Frontenac to well over that $1 million figure. The Correctional Service of Canada has also confirmed that milk will no longer be supplied to area food banks, as the farms had previously been doing. Beyond the milk are also the thousands of eggs that were too supplied by the Frontenac Institution to other federal penitentiaries. Other recent developments this past week, the city of Kingston has reaffirmed and strengthened a motion calling upon the Canadian government to reconsider the closures. And also this past week on June 14th was the setting up of a community on watch station, otherwise known as COWS, a 24-hour-a-day volunteer-driven effort where prison farm supporters are now on watch for any attempts by the Correctional Service of Canada to truck the dairy herd off the property and be taken to auction. The Frontenac herd was scheduled to be sold off by the end of the month, along with other herds at New Brunswick's Westmoreland facility and Manitoba's Rockwood Institution. According to local dairy farmer and NFU member Diane Dowling of the Save Our Prison Farms campaign, who spoke with Deconstructing Dinner, if any sign of the cows leaving is witnessed by a volunteer, a series of telephone calls will be initiated that will then reach hundreds of people who have committed to show up and block the trucks. Dowling is encouraging anyone living in the area to sign up by visiting the campaign website at saveourprisonfarms.ca. This is Deconstructing Dinner, produced at Kootenai Co-op Radio, CJLY, in Nelson, British Columbia. I'm John Steinman. If you've missed any of today's episode, it is archived online at deconstructingdinner.ca and posted under the June 17th, 2010 broadcast. There you'll also find links to our ongoing series on this prison farms issue. And also on the site, links to our new iPhone and iPod Touch app that allows for easy access to our weekly episodes and bonus content. And if you are a regular listener of the show, we're also encouraging you to support support our work with a donation or a voluntary subscription. Deconstructing Dinner is almost entirely funded by listener donations, and it seems like every year we fall well short of our modest budget that helps sustain this weekly show that's provided to you and to radio stations free of charge. So please support this independent radio show and podcast. Again, you can do so on our website, deconstructingdinner.ca, or you can send a check or money order to Deconstructing Dinner, care of Kootenai Co-op Radio, 308 A Hall Street, Nelson, BC, and the postal code V1L1Y8. This address is also posted on our website, and you can call 250-352-9600 for more information. Backyard chickens, another subject that we focus quite a lot of attention on here on the show, and for good reason. Just as the prison farm issue encompasses so many important food security matters, raising chickens within urban centers is too a window into some fundamental social, health, environmental, political, and animal welfare concerns, to name just a few. While many U.S. cities permit the raising of hens within city limits, many Canadian cities do not. The hometown of Deconstructing Dinner, for one, here in Nelson, British Columbia, does not permit backyard hens. This despite the city council having debated the issue over the past year. With that debate seemingly off the table, local bylaw enforcement seems to be out in full force, having cracked down on Nelson resident Monica Nissen, who we featured on a recent episode. And since then, yet another Nelson household has too been busted by city bylaw enforcement, and their chickens are too now no longer within the city. But that's another story for another show. Instead, the focus today is how supporters of backyard hens can work with municipalities to encourage changes to prohibitive bylaws. There are many cities across Canada who are receiving that pressure, cities like Ottawa, Toronto, Waterloo, Calgary, Halifax, and Kamloops, to name just a few. But the latest success story is the city of Vancouver, where on June 8th it became official. Vancouver residents can now raise backyard hens, just as neighboring residents can in the cities of Surrey, Burnaby, New Westminster, and Richmond. So how did this all unfold in Vancouver, and what might other Canadian efforts learn from Vancouver's? One strategy employed that is worth reflecting on was the creation of a food policy council within the city, a volunteer-run group who advises the city of Vancouver on food systems issues. In February 2007, the food policy council proposed to the city that they adopt a food charter. The food charter was seen as a way to provide a foundation to future policy decisions on food system concerns, backyard hens being one of many possibilities. So let's step back a few years and reflect on this multi-year process that no doubt assisted the city towards this latest policy change allowing backyard hens. On February 15th, 2007, Barbara Jaugen, who was involved in the Food Policy Council's Food Charter Subcommittee, spoke to the City of Vancouver's Standing Committee on Planning and Environment. Jaugen demonstrates that even the Food Charter 2 was backed up by some predecessor policies and goals, such as the city's economic and sustainability visions.
We're asking you to adopt a food charter for the city of Vancouver because there are some very strong benefits for doing so. And as an advisory body to City Council, the Food Policy Council has a mandate to develop a just and sustainable food system for the city of Vancouver, and to provide advice to various city initiatives in that regard. We'll use the vision and the principles that are set out in the Food Charter to guide us in our work in towards achieving that mandate. And while it is not an action statement, the principles in the Food Charter contain the seeds of action. And we really learned this when we took the draft Food Charter out into the community and met with people and heard their concerns about different food system issues in their neighborhoods. We learned some other things as well. We learned that the Food Charter is a very successful tool for engaging people in conversations about something they think is very important. And also that kind of citizen engagement has some very positive spin-offs for civic pride and for enhancing public trust. And we also learned that the Food Charter has enormous potential for networking across city neighborhoods and for inspiring people to initiate projects and actions to address local food security and food system issues in their neighborhoods. It gets people working together in a very strong way. And similarly, the Food Charter acts as a reference document for food system policy within the city organization itself, and it can help the city reach some of its goals. For example, one of the mayor's goals is to have the strongest local and regional economy in Canada. And similarly, one of the priorities given to council committees is to support economic development as a means of keeping our city current and at the forefront into the future. And we know that initiatives that support local agriculture and food production keep dollars in our community. And there are examples, many examples, of benefits to local economies from this kind of activity. For example, job creation and increased incomes for farmers and social enterprise food businesses, these kinds of things. Also, I won't go into any detail about the very strong links that the Food Charter has to the city's sustainability mandate. As well, as a final point, staff are currently dealing with different food system issues on an ongoing basis, and this happens in separate departments. And the Food Charter is very useful as a reference that can provide an overall vision for food system policy in the city. And those are some very, very brief comments on some of the benefits, what we see as the main benefits of adopting a food charter. We ask that you do that. And I'm going to turn it over now to Carol Christopher, and she'll speak to some of the implications of doing so. Thank you very much.
Barbara Jaugen, who involved with the Vancouver Food Policy Council, was heard there introducing their proposed food charter to Vancouver's Standing Committee on Planning and Environment. Also helping speak to the proposed food charter back in February 2007 was Carol Christopher, also of the Vancouver Food Policy Council.
What are the implications of having a food charter? And I thought I would address my remarks to that question, drawing on the experience of Kamloops, excuse me, and Toronto, who are the cities that have had food charters for the longest. So the first thing that I think we could expect from a food charter is that it will support the work of the Vancouver Food Policy Council as an advisory group, and also the work of the Vancouver Food Policy Coordinator, Deborah Kahn, in her collaboration with staff around meeting the key goals of sustainability and social goals of the city. And that's proven to be the case in both Kamloops and Toronto, where they have said that, in fact, one of the key benefits that they have from their charter is that it does provide an atmosphere or an environment that's supportive to staff that are working in that area of food policy. The second point is about fundraising. Both Toronto and Kamloops have leveraged their position with the city to raise funds for important projects that they're involved with. We would like to do the same here in Vancouver, and we think being able to point to the food charter as an expression of support from City Council will enhance our capacity to do that. The third point is about the community and catalyzing action in the community. We already have an early reading of how the community feels about the food charter. They're very excited about it. There are some in the community who already regard this as their document, their guiding document for work that they're doing at the neighborhood level. I asked people from the community to write brief letters of support for the food charter. I hope you received those. I got copied on 34 letters from individuals and several of them institutions or organizations that are very importantly involved with food policy work. I want to give you just a few examples of kinds of things that are happening. I could do this for several cities, but I'm only going to do it briefly for Toronto, because they do have a very broad range of things that they're working on. So, as an example, Toronto raised $3.5 million to increase access to affordable and healthy food. The Food Policy Council did that. as well. They're involved with a lot of research that's used in a lot of contexts around food and health in the city of Toronto. They do a lot of public events. It turns out that their city council is quite interested in having the city hall be a people place. So the Food Policy Council actually sponsors events in City Hall, and they actually sponsor a weekly farmers market from spring until fall. I noticed some smiling faces. If you'd like to do that, we can certainly talk about that. One of the things that I think they've done that is very, very important, they initiated a project called Local Flavor Plus, and that was something that eventually was spun off into a business that has a contract with the University of Toronto to provide local and organic food into their food system. I think that's brilliant. And I think there's every opportunity that something like that could happen in Vancouver as well. These are just a few of the kinds of examples of activities that can be catalyzed in the community. There's a huge amount of interest in the international community about climate change. The senior governments are coming on board, the public is aroused, the media is very interested, paying attention. And the thing that's important to realize is that food is a very major player in climate change. There's more, the energy costs of food are greater than the energy costs of individual private vehicles. For every metabolic calorie that we get out of our food, we have to put 10 fossil fuel calories into it. Now, we don't really have to do that. That's the way the present system is organized. But it can be changed. And if you look at the food charter, you realize that a lot of what's there is concerned with shifting the kinds of behaviors around in the food system so that we shift that energy equation to a more balanced one. So adopting the food charter reaffirms that Vancouver is very much a leader in this area. I'll close with a quote from Wayne Roberts, who's the coordinator of the Toronto Food Policy Council. And he says, "The food charter is my guiding document. It carries no power of enforcement. It does carry the power of ideas, of inspired individuals, and empowered communities, and that's what gives us influence. And it's in that spirit that the Vancouver Food Policy Council is very pleased and very proud to present the Vancouver Food Charter to you and to ask for its adoption."
This is Deconstructing Dinner. On today's episode, we're reflecting on the multi-year process that helped support the City of Vancouver's June 8th official adoption of a bylaw that permits the raising of backyard hens within city limits. With many supporters of backyard hens within Canadian cities seeming to be having difficulty convincing city councils to change their prohibitive bylaws, today's broadcast is reflecting on the process that one city has gone through that has proven to be successful. It appears one of the key foundational policy documents that helped support the allowance of backyard hens was Vancouver's Food Charter, which we just heard Carol Christopher speaking about back in February 2007. It was then that she and other members of the Vancouver Food Policy Council proposed that the city adopt the charter, which indeed they later did. The charter, which is linked to on the Deconstructing Dinner website under today's June 17th episode, presents a, quote, vision for a food system which benefits our community and the environment. It sets out the City of Vancouver's commitment to the development of a coordinated municipal food policy and animates our community's engagement and participation in conversations and actions related to food security in Vancouver, end quote. Fast forward to early 2009, that very food charter became a key piece in a motion put forward by City Councillor Andrea Reimer that called upon the city to investigate allowing backyard hens to be permitted within the city. That motion, which is too linked to on the Deconstructing Dinner website, makes specific reference to the city's food charter, and in particular, it references the city's, quote, commitment to the development of a coordinated municipal food policy that recognizes access to safe, sufficient, culturally appropriate, and nutritious food as a basic human right for all Vancouver residents, end quote. The motion was presented to City Council in March 2009. Heard here is Mayor Gregor Robertson.
We are moving on to motion number 3, which is legalizing backyard hens, which needs to be moved by Councillor Reimer, and I believe seconded by Councillor Deal. Councillor Reimer, will you introduce your motion, please?
I thought it might be helpful for council to get a bit of clarification on where this motion comes from, because I know there's been some confusion in the media around this. About a year ago now, a citizen wrote to the previous council, quite upset that they were not allowed to legally keep hens, or in this case, two hens, in the city of Vancouver. That letter was given to Councillor Ladner, as the former Councillor Ladner, as the liaison to the Food Policy Council. The Food Policy Council subsequently discussed it, struck a subcommittee, undertook 5 months of work, wrote a report, an election happened in the interim, and it ended up on my desk as a former member of the Food Policy Council. I know there's been many concerns brought forward about different aspects of hen husbandry in the city of Vancouver. However, it is my opinion that the Food Policy Council's work indicates that a number of other jurisdictions, in fact, if a chicken were to make a decision to cross Boundary Road, it could live there quite legally and healthily under the guidelines that Burnaby has for the keeping of hens. So this motion, which I'd also like to clarify, doesn't suggest that we just simply wave a wand and pass the bylaw, but we, in order for staff to undertake policy work to be able to develop guidelines, they need direction from council to do that, and this motion seeks that direction from council.
Thank you, Councillor Reimer. We have received requests to speak to this motion. If council is in agreement, we will refer this motion to the Standing Committee on Planning and Environment this Thursday.
Vancouver City Councillor Andrea Reimer and Mayor Gregor Robertson. As indicated, that motion ended up in committee on March 5th, 2009. It was there where councillors were able to question city staff on the motion and hear statements from guests. One of the issues presented by Councillor David Cadman was concern over disease risks.
Yeah, I want to pose a question to Nick Lucido, if I could.
He's actually... Oh,
yeah, he's here.
Yep.
What are the protocols that you're going to need in place to deal with the risk of avian flu?
That's essentially an up-to-date analysis of what the impacts might be, what protocols should be in place in case there is an outbreak, what are the... Are there elevated risks of an outbreak? And beyond avian flu, I think we want to look at other public health risks that are associated with it. So we would hopefully be able to have that within the next month or so and feed that back into the staff process.
So are we going to have to know who is keeping chickens?
That might be part of the protocol. And that makes it much more complex. It kind of speaks to a, God forbid, a permitting system or some kind of tracking system. I hope we don't have to, but if you have an outbreak in backyards, it may not spread as fast as it does in a concentrated industrial chicken raising plant. But the concern that Dr. Daly and I have is that certainly the outbreaks in Asia that are related to chickens in our backyard variety, and the concern is that the chance of transmission to humans is a lot greater in that type of situation. That's why, and we're not experts on this, that's why we've asked BCCDC and perhaps through extension to World Health Organization and CDC Atlanta for a bit more information. There's conflicting information and I guess two ends of the spectrum from even the medical and veterinary professionals. So there was a workshop last year about this time in Abbotsford. And one of the outputs from that was the opinion, I think it was the Canadian Food Inspection Agency, who commented that the risk of avian flu was increased in a backyard situation. And I think we've seen evidence from the staff report or from the Food Council report that actually would argue the other myth, I think, from the Ministry of Agriculture. So I think we're probably looking for clarity as much as council is looking for clarity about, is it an acceptable risk that's being added? What are the risks and how do you mitigate those risks? And I think there's some good suggestions about maintenance of the backyard flock, cleaning of shoes and things like that. I guess when you enact a policy, it's aimed at the general population, but there's always a percentage of the population that don't comply with bylaws and perhaps don't adhere to policies and best practices. So we should be aiming at that population rather than the what I'd call the responsible pet owners, chicken owners, whatever you might want to call it, motorcycle drivers. You can probably extend that. So I think whatever your staff come up with, I hope we have a chance to work with them on that, that they will be aiming those steps and procedures and policies at the lowest common denominator rather than the best backyard chicken farmer.
Vancouver staff member Nick Lucido answering a question posed by Councillor David Cadman on disease risks among backyard hens. Another question posed by Cadman at that March 2009 committee meeting was with respect to waste, a concern that has often been raised within other similar municipal conversations being held across the country.
What complications does this introduce in terms of the waste? And by that I mean excrement, but also the whole issue of how one processes a backyard chicken and the risks of salmonella.
Again, those are all risks that have been identified in the literature, and we just want to get as much of the up-to-date science as we can. Again, there's best practices that can be followed, and I believe that those would minimize the risk. I think if Dr. Blatherwick were here still today, he'd say, you can never get zero risk, so it's how much risk the community and council is willing to accept. There's an issue around, I take it, most of the initiative is around the egg production and the use of eggs, but there's always an end-of-life issue, I guess, with the chicken. So how do we dispose of the carcass? Are we going to end up with complaints of backyard slaughter of chickens for food purposes after their egg-laying days are over? So those are a lot of the unanswered questions that I think need to be looked at.
Also addressing the waste issue was Councillor Andrea Reimer, who introduced the motion. Andrea brought up an often overlooked presence of other animals in the city, cats and dogs.
We have cats and dogs. I've never owned a cat or a dog, but I'm going to guess if you own one, eventually they die and you have to do something with them. So how does that work?
Well, normally, I guess I'm a dog owner and a cat owner, too, and I ended up having to bury a small puppy in the backyard. I don't know if that would be, at least from our experience, and I go back to 30 years of actually enforcing the provision that you're proposing to, or administering the provision you're proposing to eliminate, and we did respond to complaints those years, and some of them were around the backyard slaughter of not only chickens, but I recall one regarding a rather large either ostrich or emu in the backyard. So those things do happen. So there are ways of doing it that I'd say are rather humane and also not impacting on your direct neighbors that can be done in a proper way. I suppose some people use the, I have to say this carefully around my engineering friends, but use the garbage system to dispose of dead carcasses as well, even though that's contrary to, I think, provincial law.
Okay, so basically our health system right now, if your pet dies of natural causes or even unnatural ones, you can take out a shovel and put it in your backyard?
I don't believe we have any laws or rules against that, no.
Okay. That's interesting to know. Thank you. As a renter, I look at every place I've lived in totally differently now.
Vancouver City Councillor Andrea Reimer, who on March 2009 introduced a motion designed to instruct the city to repeal the city's prohibition of raising backyard hens and develop a recommended set of guidelines and policies for permitting them. On June 8, 2010, that process was officially over, and hens are now legally permitted within the city. And so on today's episode, and continuing into next week's, we're reflecting on the many steps that were taken to arrive at this latest and successful bylaw change, because as it happens, many backyard hen hopefuls in other Canadian cities are finding themselves encountering some strong opposition. Also at that March 2009 committee meeting where the motion in Vancouver was first discussed, a number of speakers were invited to address the motion. The first person heard here had been raising chickens in the city for many years.
I was raised in and around Vancouver. My mother introduced her boys to backyard chicken keeping in Burnaby in the 1960s, and we subsequently took our chickens with us to Richmond and then to Port Coquitlam. And I guess I was sufficiently inspired by the experience that when I graduated, I went into the Faculty of Agriculture at UBC into the pre-veterinary medicine program. And while at UBC, I worked for Canada Agriculture and their poultry research facility in Agassiz. So I think I'm reasonably well qualified to speak to the subject. I eventually settled in Kitsilano, bought a house there in the early 1990s. At that time, I thought that I would acquaint a new generation with the simple pleasures that I've been afforded as youth with backyard chicken keeping. And but before doing so, I consulted then Councillor Rankin, because he was reputed or rumored to be a bird keeper at his residence at Trout Lake. And he told me at the time that the bylaw did not then allow for the keeping of chickens, but that if I was discreet and I didn't have a rooster and I didn't cause a ruckus with my neighbors, that I should be able to get away with it, which we did for a number of years. And our very small flock became quite a novelty in the neighborhood, with the garbage collectors and with the neighbors and with the kids from General Gordon Elementary and the Montessori preschool across the street, many of whom had never seen a live chicken before and thought that eggs came from a styrofoam box from the Safeway. So it was a good lesson for the kids, and it was a well worthwhile endeavor. I was recently reacquainted to the debate on allowing hens in the city or poultry, and given my background, I became quite actively involved. As it now stands, the city of Vancouver allows the keeping of 12 exotic birds, and exotic birds is not well defined, and in fact, to previous speaker's point, I think you could keep 12 ostriches in your backyard in the city of Vancouver, according to the bylaw. And to the best of my knowledge, there have been no avian influenza issues nor any animal welfare issues, even though this is a longstanding bylaw. To the subject of backyard poultry keeping and animal welfare, I think that we would all be agreed that it's a far more humane alternative to commercial poultry production, in which genetic alteration is used to promote production, egg production, and growth, and beak trimming, some would refer to as mutilation, is required to reduce fighting of distressed and crowded birds. And I know that if chickens could talk, that they would implore the animal rights activists to encourage council to pass this bylaw, because every 2 to 4 chickens that end up in a residence in Vancouver are going to be 2 to 4 chickens that are not in a battery cage in a commercial poultry production. And again, having seen both sides of this, I can tell you that a backyard is Club Med for chickens compared to a space that is quite literally that big that is afforded commercial raised hens. So I'm really hopeful that the animal rights and welfare activists get on board and not only don't oppose this, but lead the crusade, because it's a good thing. And it's a good thing that has been adopted by 65% of American cities. And I'm quite frankly a little embarrassed that the city of Vancouver is not only not taking the lead on this, but is coming up behind most of the cities in the United States and a good number of cities in British Columbia and Canada. So I'm hopeful that we follow the lead that's been established by Las Vegas and Minneapolis and Boston and New York and Los Angeles and Atlanta and Portland, Oregon and Portland, Maine. To the subject of avian influenza, I would say most public health officials see small-scale poultry rearing as a response to the problem. Essentially, the low density and genetic diversity of backyard flocks contribute to low viral load and keep the birds with stronger natural immune systems.
Okay.
I'd be happy to answer any questions at any time.
This is Deconstructing Dinner, and that was a resident of Vancouver addressing the city's Standing Committee of Council on Planning and Environment in March 2009. That meeting was where a motion calling for changes to the city's prohibition of backyard chickens was first discussed. We'll be extending this show into next week's, but we'll hear from one more resident who spoke at that meeting, a newcomer to the city, but someone who arrived from another city where backyard hens have long been permitted, Portland, Oregon.
My name's Heather, and I have an agricultural degree from Oregon State University and an emphasis with animal science, and I'm a longtime backyard chicken owner. And I sold products to backyard chicken people in Portland, Oregon for 10 years. And so I think I'm a very highly qualified backyard chicken discussing person. I I came here from Portland about a year ago, and Portland is a huge chicken city. Everybody and their brothers got chickens in Portland, and it's a veteran chicken friendly city. They've had them for quite a long time. Everybody has gotten along. The shelters haven't filled up with chickens. City officials haven't been clogged with chicken complaints. It's the home of the Tour de Coupes, which is, it's beautiful. It's very, very popular. And it's a tour of various chicken coops in the city where you get to see, because people just let their imaginations go wild and they build very beautiful, beautiful chicken coops sometimes. And you get to see their beautiful chickens because there's very many heritage breeds out there and you get to see their gardens. Anyway, it can be a really fun thing for the city. Kids, families, communities, schools, everybody that comes into contact with backyard chickens likes them. It's just the people that don't know them yet that don't like them. I wanted to mention that hens do not require roosters to make eggs, and hens only cluck. They don't crow. So those are the two biggest complaints, and nobody's talking about roosters. And even if nobody prohibited roosters, they would still, if they crowed and it bothered anybody, the noise bylaws would cover that, so that would be fine. As for their waste, my two hens generate probably less than a cup of poop a day. I mean, it's less complicated than cleaning a litter box, and you just chuck it in the composter, and it's clean. You compost it for a year. If anything, it's not enough manure. I still have to buy manure for my garden. And I wanted to mention that because I am very qualified to talk about this issue and I'm very interested in this issue, I have actually talked to a BC Ministry of Ag and Lands veterinarian about the avian flu thing. I talked to him personally, and he personally told me that they personally had a conference about this, and this happened in February that I had this conversation. And he had a conference with other veterinarians with the government, and their current view was that backyard small flocks were not a problem. They were not an issue. They weren't something that they were worried about for avian flu. They thought, if anything, the backyard flocks, given that they're going to be very healthy, they're going to have genetic diversity, they're going to be pets, and so if they're sick, their owners will take them to the vet. If anything, they're an early warning system for something that they don't even think is going to happen. I also am aware that animal rights activists aren't quite sure how they feel about this issue, and I probably have more in common with them than I do not in common with them. I'm a humongous animal lover. It's what I studied in school. I've had animals all my life. I'll have animals all my life. I keep them until they die of natural causes. I take them to the vet when necessary. And the way I see it is, these animal rights activists spend their days dealing with abused and neglected animals and people that abuse and neglect animals. How they go through life without going insane, I have no idea. And I have the utmost respect and compassion and sympathy and everything for people that do that every day. And I think that we're all on the same page. I think that we all want healthy, happy chickens that don't have any problems, that have veterinary care.
That was audio from a March 2009 committee meeting of the City of Vancouver, where a motion to repeal Vancouver's bylaw that had prohibited backyard hens was first discussed. On next week's episode, we'll continue with this feature on the successful efforts of Vancouver residents to encourage their city to allow backyard chickens. On June 8, 2010, it did become official that Vancouver residents can now raise hens. Next week, we'll hear more from that March 2009 meeting, including some opposition from animal welfare groups, and we'll continue listening in on how the bylaw change evolved up to the present day. In the meantime, you can access resources on today's topic by visiting the Deconstructing Dinner website at deconstructingdinner.ca and our June 17th, 2010 broadcast. There you'll also find links to our ongoing series on backyard hens, a series that is a part of our broader series titled Farming in the City. Oh! And that was this week's edition of Deconstructing Dinner, produced and recorded at Nelson, British Columbia's Kootenai Co-op Radio. I've been your host, John Steinman. I thank my technical assistant, John Ryan. The theme music for Deconstructing Dinner is courtesy of Nelson area resident Adam Shake. This radio show is provided free of charge to campus community radio stations across the country and relies on the financial support from you, the listener. Support for the program can be donated through our website at deconstructingdinner.ca or by dialing 250-352-9600.